Accession number 30276, Reel 2.
Precautions being made for a possible invasion.
Yes. There was, it got out, and I figure how it got out about the Brisbane line. The Australian government at the time had decided that they would let, if the Japs invaded, they would let them take the top end of Australia and they would draw a line across at Brisbane. And it was called the Brisbane line, and there was a lot of outrage when that was made known that they were not going to defend Australia. Maybe they would have defended in a sort of guerrilla warfare or something like that, but they would have, they wouldn't have really got into the battle until they got as far as Brisbane, if they got that far. And they probably thought that their lines of communication, because we didn't have a train line, we didn't have roads there really, and they would have been difficult to transport an army overland from Darwin or the north as far as Brisbane. It would have been a pretty horrendous task. And it may have been made good sense, but a lot of people that were in the area north of Brisbane weren't very happy about that. And there was a lot of resentment. But anyway, that just passed. And we started pushing the Japs back. And
ships were sunk in Sydney Harbour.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. And, of course, here in Western Australia, the Derby and Broome were bombed quite frequently. A lot of damage was done at Broome and Derby. And but they were raids that the Japanese were in. I think they were intimidatory raids. What we can do, we'll show you what we can do. I think the Americans did the same thing when they sent Doolittle across and those Mitchell bombers across from an aircraft carrier and bombed Japan. Showed the Japanese. That must have been a horrendous shock to the Japanese that they could be bombed. And the same, the Japanese were trying to show us that they get into Sydney Harbour and so on. It was all, it wasn't a serious invasion, it was just intimidatory, I think.
What have you heard of obviously later on, July of 42, things like the Kokoda Track? Choco soldiers were up there.
Oh, that's right, yeah, because that New Guinea was part of Australia at that time. And the militia could be sent to New Guinea. New Guinea and the Bougainville, the islands and the Solomons were all under Australian. Half of New Guinea was Dutch and half was Australia, and the Solomon Islands and Bougainville and those places, they could send troops, Rabaul, New Britain. And in fact, a lot of the militia were sent to Rabaul and to New Guinea, and they were the first ones that fought the Japanese up there.
What have you heard of things like the Kokoda Track? We hear stories of...
Oh, well, my battalion did the Kokoda Track. And I'll tell you, once the... I hadn't joined the battalion at that time. It was after that that I went, but I heard all about it. And out of our battalion, there were only 12, I think, that started and finished. The 2nd 33rd Battalion, they either got wounded, killed, sick, malaria, scrub, typhus, there was dengue fever, all sorts of diseases, dysentery and one thing or another, but 12 of them went from beginning to end. They finished the whole campaign, and that was out of a battalion of about 900.
So what stories were you hearing about what war could be like? And obviously you hear, you could get sick and you could get killed. Have you ever thought that maybe if you did join the army, you might not get home?
Yeah, that's right, yes. But, if you're young, we were young men at that time, if you see these young fellas driving cars recklessly around, they don't see themselves ever being killed, do they? They think it'll always be somebody else. And I think we thought that too, that the young men feel that way, that, yeah, somebody will get killed, but probably won't be me. They feel invincible at that age and are not aware of all the dangers that they're facing. And I thought about it a bit, but then, of course, when I got into action, I thought about it a lot more. that I realised that I could be killed, and I learned fear, real fear at that time.
People also talk of one of their main worries is that they'll come back badly wounded.
Yeah.
Almost worse than being killed.
I must admit that I didn't think about it very much. I don't think I want to think about it. I was very scared at times when I was close to and people were killed alongside me. But there's a funny thing that happens that if you're under that sort of... To me it did, and I think it's happened to others. If you're under heavy fire and there are casualties and you don't get hurt, you survive okay, you're not badly wounded and you're still alive, there's a feeling of exhilaration that you've survived, that you got out of it. I think that's the most powerful feeling than those that are secondary. You think of the ones that have been killed. It's after, you know, the initial thing when it's over, the bombardment's over, whatever, you're exhilarated that you're still in one piece and you're alive. And then after that comes when you see somebody being buried and then sadness and the...
Well, we can talk certainly about, when you hear of this sort of the stress suddenly hits you afterwards, or you have this sort of moment of realisation of what you've been through sometime after. We can talk about that a bit later on, but had you ever, and your father, you mentioned, maybe had been a bit more sensible than his mates and possibly been a bit of a coward. Had you ever thought what it might be like to line someone up and have to shoot, have to pull that trigger?
I would have done it without worrying about it, had it happened. But as a Sig, although I was armed and I carried a rifle or an Aran gun, my job was laying down telephone wire, moving along with the company into action, setting up a telephone, laying the cable, then setting up a... most of our communications between companies, infantry companies and their battalion headquarters, was telephone, a telephone wire. Once we took up the position we were trying to take, we would then connect the phone. It was an earth return, just two little batteries and an earth return. And then we had communication with battalion headquarters. Then we could get on the phone and say we'd had casualties or we'd reached our objective, we're under attack, we needed reinforcements or assistance or whatever had to be done. And that was my job. Dig a hole, get in it with the phone and stay there. And then if the line was cut, we had to go out and repair it, and that was a bit hairy because you didn't know whether whoever cut the line was still waiting there for you to turn up. But apart from that, I didn't have to go on patrol. I didn't have to lead. We went along in the rear, pulling the cable and running the cable on and keeping in communication with battalion headquarters, because communications were very, very important. Any company that was cut off from battalion headquarters, anything could happen, and who knows? The radios didn't work in those days; they were hopeless, and they were too heavy, and they didn't work in once you got into a heavy forest, because the forest cut out the. But the telephone always worked.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that too. Your initial experiences of becoming a soldier. Your initial experiences of being in the army, what was that like?
Well, I remember vividly the first day. The first day, getting a uniform, getting into army boots, army uniform and things. It was... nothing seemed to fit properly. My first rate coat was issued to me, and it was manufactured in 1916. It had been in the First World War, been brought back and kept in ordnance somewhere, and then it was issued again. And my rifle had been manufactured in 1915, a 303 Enfield. So we had older, and although we had some Vickers guns, we also had German Spandau guns, which was like a Vickers gun, had been captured from the Germans in France in the First World War, brought back to Australia, and we were using those, training on those. And my first day, of course, was getting a sort of a chaff bag full of straw for a bed, and issued with blankets, and all our equipment, and going for needles, you know, getting all sorts of needles. I'd never had a needle before in my life, but suddenly I was being jabbed with all sorts of with things, and army food. I can remember the first meal was army stew, which was almost always army stew, and this young bloke, he was there, and I heard him say, I'd never eaten stew in my life. I don't eat stew. And the sergeant said, well, you don't eat it, son. Don't eat it. Your mother wouldn't cook it for you. You don't eat it. And he wouldn't eat it, but he did the next day. You know, we got very, very quickly we learned what army life was about. And there was no mollycoddling or anything like that. You really were pulled into line, and probably I think that the most young men should do army service. I think it's a good experience, discipline, taking orders, and putting up with things without bitching and whining about them. And I must admit that nearly 5 years I spent in the army, I made friends that lasted all my life. It was an adventure. I travelled, went overseas, travelled in ships, went interstate, I went to Western Australia and up to Darwin. These things, Sydney and all that, these are things that I only dreamed about, and suddenly I did it. And for most part, and a single man, I didn't have a girlfriend, I had nobody to worry about at home, you know, I wasn't love sick or anything like that, and I thought I enjoyed the army life. There were bad times, but for the most of it, I was quite happy to be in the army.
Mm. So you were talking about this early training period and really sort of starting to realise what you're in for. What was this army life like, the day-to-day routine, particularly early on?
Well, the army routine was... I remember the reveille, you know, it was a bugle call. You were out of bed, on parade. That took a bit of getting used to. Doing your own laundry. I remember I didn't do any laundry for the first week until my sergeant said, when are you going to wash that towel? I said, when I leave, my mother will do it for me. And didn't he get stuck into me? Your mother... And it suddenly dawned on me, my mother won't be doing my laundry, I've got to do it. And I'd never washed a thing in my life. And suddenly I had to wash my own underpants and towel and socks. And he woke me up. First week I didn't think about it, I was just putting them aside. When I got leave, I'd take them out and mum would do it. Well, so you sort of grew up pretty quickly, I suppose I can put it that way. And,
Well, here you are, a mix of blokes you'd never met before, sort of getting to know one another, presumably, you know, sort of...
Most you liked, most you didn't like. And I can remember I shouldn't say most you didn't like, some you didn't like. You didn't fancy them and thought that they were not the sort of person you want to be friendly with. And but others you went to straight away, you know, you got on well with them, you came from probably the same backgrounds and that sort of thing, had the same interests. I was pretty big for my for young men of my age at that time. I was 6'3" and I could look after myself. I'd worked in hard labouring jobs, and I'd done a bit of boxing and played football. And I was fully confident that I could handle myself with anybody. And I can remember the first or second day we went into the mess hut, and I put my knife and fork and mess tins down, and I went away to do something. I can't remember what it was. When I came back, my knife and fork had gone. And I said, what happened to my knife and fork? And they said, that big guy up there, the fat guy, he took them. And he was one of the old soldiers, you know. And we were just recruits. And I knew at that time I had to go up and confront this bloke. So I went up and I said, you've got my knife and fork. And I picked them up. And I said, the next time you touch my stuff, I'll stick this fork up your nose. And he never said a word. I think he saw that I was so angry that I would do it. And then I went back and sat down. And from then on, I had a reputation. There was another fellow that had done a bit of boxing. And he had a few drinks one night, wanted to fight me. And we had a fight, and I won that. So, and knocked him down a couple of times. And I had a reputation. And that's the thing. I think you get a reputation in the army, whether you're stupid or whether you're not, whether you can be pushed around or stood over or not, and it was a good thing to make sure you got a reputation, and there was also the reliability thing that you, with mates when you're in action, if you can't trust them, and you can't rely on them, well, you don't get on with them. But for most part, in my mates, we trusted each other and we stuck by each other, and they were the ones you made a lasting lifetime relationship. You never forgot them, you cared about them, and you're happy to see them any time until they died. And most of them are now dead, of course.
Well, that would be something certainly that you would develop as the war developed.
As the war developed, you get these close affiliations with certain men that got the same background as you, and maybe not same personality or whatever, or people that you knew you could trust them. You could lend them some money and they'd pay you back, or you knew if you rely on them to back you up in action, they would back you up. And even though they might be scared themselves, they would take risks, you know, if it was necessary. And you relied on them. If you didn't rely on them in action, there'd be a panic, and you would, you know, a whole thing could start. And I've heard of it, that somebody starts to run, and then everybody panics and starts to run. So didn't happen in my experience, but
what were you being taught about the job of soldiering? What were you having to learn to be a good soldier?
To be a good soldier, you had to, your equipment, you had to be reliable. If you were told by an officer or an NCO to do a thing, you did it. You didn't hesitate, you didn't complain. It was an order and you did it. And I think that's what they try to drum into you, that if they told you to go there and do that, you did it. And I don't think an army can work if it does. It's not like that. If an officer can't give orders that'll be obeyed, well, you know, where are you going to go? The whole thing would fall apart. So that was one of the things that were drummed into the army, and all services, that you were told you had to do something, you did it. Whether you wanted to or not, whether you were scared or not, you did it. And I think that's what the main lesson of the army was. And we became, I think, we became very disciplined. Not as disciplined as maybe some armies, but I think the Australians were well disciplined, and I heard that a lot of people say they weren't. They were a rabble, but in my experience, I don't think they were. I think they, maybe when they're on leave, they're a bit of a rabble, but when they're in action, I don't think they were.
Well, people do talk of this sort of casual attitude that presumably the Australians had. They didn't have the same sort of stand up and salute sort of principles in them or something.
Well, I think that the British Army everybody had to salute everybody and call them sir and stand strictly to attention and all that sort of business. Discipline was drummed into them much more severely than it was us. And I think that was because the officers didn't expect you to do those sort of things. There were, when you're on parade, and there were, or you were being, you know, certain regulations and duties, then there was discipline. You saluted and you, sir. But away from that, I don't think Australian officers wanted their junior men to be in fear of them, or to put them on a pedestal, or treat them as if they were some sort of lord, you know. I think it was a different... Australians had a different attitude. We were different from Britain. I believe that in the British Army, I'm not sure if it's true or not, that if a lance corporal was made corporal, he was transferred to another battalion because he'd made mates and now he was giving them orders. He couldn't do it, but he could if he went to another battalion, then they were strangers. But the Australian Army didn't do that, and I think discipline was sufficient. I don't say it was as highly organised as the British Army or some other, but probably the Germans. But it was we got by. I'm glad it wasn't, actually. I don't think I could have stood that, you know, sucking up and saluting and bowing and scraping to.
Well, people talk of calling their officers by their first name. I mean,
yeah.
That would have been unheard of, presumably, in something like the British Army.
Yeah. Well, we never called them by their first name, except in times when, you know, everybody was letting their hair down. For instance, we had nicknames for our officers, if we liked them. If we didn't like them, we didn't have nicknames, but, you know, it might be Paddles or Shanko or something like that. And that if we had a nickname for them and called them other than by their correct name, it meant we liked them, and they accepted it. They were our officers, and they gave orders, and we obeyed them. But apart from that, we could talk to them. You know, like I can talk to you. We would play tricks on them, do all sorts of things.
Such as
I can remember putting a lizard in my lieutenant's pocket. A blue tongue lizard. I knew he was frightened. And then I asked him, did he have a match? And when he put his hand in, he felt the lizard. And he got the shock of his life, and he tore his greatcoat off, and big blue tongue lizard came out. But he saw the joke, and he just said, you bastard. And nothing was done about it. That sort of thing, yeah.